Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. Official statistics show that Muslims are the most targeted group in the UK, with nearly 3,500 hate crimes perpetrated against Muslims in England and Wales last year. So on today's show, we're going to ask why Islamophobia is reaching epidemic proportions and what can be done about it.
On the 29th of March, around 11 p.m., an elderly Muslim man walking home from his local masjid was viciously attacked by three men. The unprovoked assault left the 73-year-old victim hospitalized with a broken hand and multiple cuts to the face. The incident is just the latest example of an all-too-common event in Britain, Islamophobic hate crimes. The UK has a severe problem with anti-Muslim discrimination. Unchecked political rhetoric, combined with hostile media coverage, has created fear and mistrust, the seeds which breed hatred of the close to 4 million Muslims living in England. Right-wing terrorism poses a constant threat, with a far-right teenager found guilty of planning to murder Muslims at two mosques in England in March 2023. Unfortunately, some terrorists have been more successful, as was the case with Mohammed Salim, who was murdered in cold blood by Ukrainian neo-Nazi Pavlo Lapshin in April 2013. Another example was a terror attack near Finsbury Park Mosque in London, 2017. Islamophobe Darren Osborne drove a van into pedestrians, killing Makram Ali, again during the Islamic Holy Month. Despite these horrific murders, the UK government remains unwilling to find a working definition of Islamophobia. Critics suspect it's due to fear many of its party members would be found guilty of anti-Muslim prejudice.
Well, joining us today to talk about Islamophobia in the UK and elsewhere, we have Omar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He pre-worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. And Farah Kutena, originally from and raised in Al-Quds, from one of the last Palestinian families in the Old City. She is also the founder of Key 48, a campaign calling for the immediate right of return of all Palestinian refugees and a referendum amongst the global Palestinian community on the future of Palestine. Welcome to the show, both of you. Farah, let me come straight to you because you've been able to join me in the studio, which I appreciate. Just tell me, why are we seeing so much anti-Muslim hatred? And not only that, but it's boiling over to a proportion where people feel that it's okay to physically assault innocent Muslims in the street. Why is it getting that bad?
It's a combination of multiple reasons. I think one of those reasons would be kind of the way in which Muslims have been depicted for the past few decades in TV series, in movies, in Hollywood, which we know has links to the CIA, kind of going along with any kind of US foreign policy that's fitting at the time. And then also we have within that culmination is British government policies, kind of prevent and other Islamophobic policies, and also kind of the attitudes of British governments at the time. You know, we know there's a rampant Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. We've had a Prime Minister, like, for example, Boris Johnson, who was extremely Islamophobic, never even really apologised, you know, let alone actually was held accountable for the Islamophobic remarks he made. And we know that there was a direct impact by those remarks. We know that his remark referring to Muslim women as letterboxes, as burgers, we know that the, you know, Islamophobic attacks on Muslim women increased by over 300% just as a direct result of that single comment he made. So it's a combination of many factors.
Omar, you're joining us over Skype, and again, welcome to the show. Just tell me, in your opinion, who's more to blame for this atmosphere of hostility towards Muslims? Do you think that it's just politicians who are to blame, or perhaps the media has a major role in causing this problem?
Well, I think it's definitely both. I mean, the British media, which of course includes print, broadcast and radio, has played and continues to play a very, very large role in stoking Islamophobia. And I think this is a very important question because the media, by and large, is an extension of the British state. So I think there's not really that clear-cut divorce between politicians and the British media. They kind of work in tandem with each other, particularly the government of the day. And the British state, of course, has been a pioneer of 21st century Islamophobia across the globe, particularly in the post-9/11 period. There's almost no media outlet in Britain that is not, at least doctrinally, an extension of the British state. There's no countercultural newspaper, television show, or radio program, really. And all of the media news outlets have dedicated liaison on staff that report to or are directly paid by the British security services in order to produce content directly for them. And similarly, defense correspondents are essentially embedded in the Ministry of Defense, regurgitating state propaganda. And on key issues of security policy, international policy, and of course, Muslims in Britain are a highly securitized community and of special interest as well in terms of international policy. There's very little that is produced in, you know, broadcast, print, and radio that's not directly generated by the state or that leans heavily on the state for both its line and its expert contributors. So I think they kind of work in tandem with each other.
But Ammar, there's also this kind of issue which is pushed. They're like conspiracy theories, misconceptions that have become quite popular in large parts of society. This idea that Muslims are the ones that are coming over here, trying to change the West, bringing their own religious practices, trying to basically a creeping Sharia. That's the idea that's being pushed around now. Do you think that there's where is this coming from? Why is this the issue that people look at Muslims with such mistrust?
I think the problem is because Britain is undergoing a huge identity crisis, and this isn't something new. This has been happening for decades. There's been a huge well of insecurity about Britishness in political discourse, and the reasons why Muslims have been attacked is because, you know, in the shadow of this declining British Empire, we've maintained our identity and they haven't, and they're confused about their identity. The decline of Christianity in particular has, I think, come as a shock to the values of society and to what people think Britain is conceptually. In the recent census, we saw that Britain really isn't any longer a Christian country. There's a huge amount of atheists and agnostic people here in Britain, but people still seem to think, well, we have our Christian cultural values, and these Muslims, these foreign barbarians, are here to subvert our, you know, the beauty of Christendom. So I think it's primarily because Brits themselves are undergoing this identity crisis.
Let me come back to you, Farah, and just ask about the Islamophobia comes in different forms. There's obviously street thugs and right-wing terrorists who commit violent acts against Muslims directly. But there's also state-backed efforts which are deemed Islamophobic, like the Prevent Countering Extremism strategy, which is basically a government-backed initiative to try and root out extremism. But there seems to be an obsession with Muslims in this policy. Just tell us a little bit about Prevent and also your own personal experiences with this strategy.
Yeah, so Prevent is, you know, a counter-terrorism strategy, a wider strategy of another policy called Contest, and it's very relevant to point out this is a policy created and formed by the Conservative Party, a right-wing party. You know, it states that it's to kind of you know, target extremism, but actually it's an attempt by a right-wing government to purge the, you know, it's left-wing citizens. And what you'll find amongst the Muslim community in the UK is that they do sit on the left. They, you know, they endorse kind of socialist policies. You know, the Muslim community really gathered behind, for example, Jeremy Corbyn in his attempts to become prime minister as well. So really they've kind of exploited Prevent to target kind of a left-wing voting base, to criminalise kind of views such as being pro-Palestine, such as, you know, so many views, even, you know, being supportive of something like Black Lives Matter, and kind of all these views that do sit on the left of the political spectrum. And from my own personal experiences of Prevent, when I was at university, it was massively used to crush our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression, when it came to Palestine, but then also marginalizing and criminalizing kind of Muslim students' right to express their religion on campus. We had members of staff fulfilling their Prevent duty, which would involve them actually kind of turning Islamic prayer rooms into multi-faith rooms, destroying prayer mats, destroying Qurans as well.
Oh, wow.
And kind of just criminalizing Muslim students on campus.
So basically, if you're a Muslim who perhaps expresses political views that are not in line with how the state's worldview, pro-Palestine sentiment, for example, I think I've even read reports of students who have accidentally said, "I live in a terrorist house," and it's been misinterpreted to mean a terrorist house. Mm-hmm. Then in comes Prevent, teachers report on students. Muslim kids are basically treated like they're criminals or terrorists.
There was one notable case of a secondary school student. He was a Muslim student, and he was simply wearing a Free Palestine badge on his school uniform. And the police raided his house because teachers then reported him to Prevent using their duty.
Well, those are some very valid points you mentioned. But of course, Islamophobia isn't just a problem in the UK, but is prevalent in all non-Muslim nations around the world. Two particularly bad cases of state-sponsored Islamophobia can be found in India and France, as the following report explains.
The rise of nationalist politics and Hindu fundamentalism has led to the marginalisation and discrimination of Muslims in India. The ruling BJP party in particular has been accused of discriminating against Muslims. In 2019, it passed the controversial Citizenship Amendment Act, which offered citizenship to non-Muslim refugees from neighbouring countries while excluding Muslims. The law sparked widespread protests and condemnation from human rights groups and the international community. In the media, Muslims are often depicted as terrorists, criminals, and anti-national elements, which has contributed to the rise of hate crimes and vigilantism against Muslims. Muslims were also blamed for the spread of the COVID-19 virus and were subjected to discrimination and violence. Lynchings of Muslims have become more common, with mobs targeting individuals suspected of consuming or selling beef, which is considered sacred by Hindus. Muslims have also been excluded from employment opportunities and denied access to education and healthcare. Meanwhile, France has the largest Muslim population in Europe, with estimates suggesting that there are between 5 and 6 million Muslims living in the country. However, they're often subjected to discrimination, social exclusion, and hate crimes. The French government has a strict separation of church and state and has banned the wearing of religious symbols in public spaces, including the hijab, niqab, and burqa. The powerful far-right National Front Party, led by Marine Le Pen, has campaigned on an anti-immigrant and anti-Islam platform, using fear-mongering tactics to appeal to voters. The party has also been accused of promoting hate speech and inciting violence against Muslims. Daesh terror attacks in France have also contributed to Islamophobia. These attacks have led to a sense of fear and mistrust amongst the wider population, with Muslims being unfairly blamed and subjected to discrimination and hate crimes. In 2021, President Emmanuel Macron introduced a new law that aimed to combat so-called Islamist separatism and promote secularism. The law includes measures such as increasing oversight of mosques and Muslim organizations, as well as restrictions on homeschooling and the issuance of halal certificates.
So there you go, some prominent examples of blatant Islamophobia in other countries. Ammar, let me bring you back in on this. Now, of course, Islamophobia is a kind of European continent-wide epidemic and has been for quite some time. We've seen a rising trend in Quran burnings, for example, which has been defended. These are far-right protests, actions which have been defended by leaders of European countries, particularly in Scandinavia and elsewhere. And of course, in France, as we've seen, there seems to be a rise in anti-Muslim sentiment in the highest levels of political life there. Could you just tell us, are you concerned that what we're seeing in France and elsewhere could be the direction in which the UK is going in, and just how far will this go? I mean, it looks to me as if we could be returning to 1930s Europe, where minorities were put into concentration camps.
Well, I am very concerned, and certainly the example of India is very apposite in terms of what you just mentioned about the 1930s, given that the Hindutva ideology that the BJP subscribes to and the RSS movement takes great inspiration from Nazism and European race science in general. I think that, you know, as Islamophobia, as you say, is a European continent-wide phenomenon, it's also a global phenomenon. We do need to be concerned about the happenings in other countries. Of course, what's happening in those other countries isn't directly comparable. What's happening in France, for example, is very much related to the fact that it's, you know, a republic, whereas Britain's a constitutional monarchy. The republic sees itself as a vanguard that imposes its values on others. But we shouldn't ever be complacent about what happens there, because often what we see with these sorts of trends is that these tactics are almost battle-tested in one area of the world, and then they end up expanding to another, particularly in the European continent. We've seen trends in terms of legislation and banning and the liquidation of Islamic assets happening not just in France, but in Germany, in Austria, and in other European countries. So we should never be under the illusion that we aren't rapidly heading in that direction here in Britain. It's potentially dangerous and complacent to engage in a game of kind of relativized victimhood, because that will, as you've rightly mentioned, could end in, you know, a march to the death camps. Islamophobia is a global industry, a global problem, and we have to be very cautious about it in this society. Otherwise, who knows, we could be in the position of those Muslims in France or in India.
Farah, obviously there is a massive issue with this, and we could talk about different countries specifically. But one thing which I find very interesting is that there's this idea that Muslims who emigrate here and settle here, they should perhaps be grateful that they live in a country where they have perhaps a bit more freedoms than they do in countries like India, where there are purges against Muslims that take place in the streets. Not necessarily as bad as that here yet, but I think that there are some who would say to Muslims, well, you should be grateful, you should be more British as a result, you shouldn't be complaining so much. What's your response to that?
I think it's quite an outrageous, sentiment. There's nothing really that Muslims should be grateful for being here. I've witnessed my Muslim friends have, female Muslim friends have had their hijabs torn off. You know, the rhetoric of Tommy Robinson has led to actions like these, and we see even just a few years ago these letters being posted around people's homes saying, you know, punish a Muslim day, and kind of offering points to harm Muslims.
Yes, those are just a few examples, but Amar, let me ask you about a specific phenomenon which has occurred recently. There's the rise in Quran burnings in Europe. The reason I come back to this is because we saw a massive Muslim reaction to recent burnings which took place in Scandinavia. Turkey got involved. They boycotted or they vetoed a bid by Sweden to join NATO, and it turned into a massive political scandal. And some may argue that the Muslim reaction to that basically achieved some results. So what I want to ask you about is how Muslims should respond to incidents of Islamophobia in whatever form they take. Do you think we need more street protests? Do you think we need more Muslims in politics? What's the solution?
Well, I think that certainly we need more advocacy for Muslims, and we need more organization. I think one of the biggest reasons why Islamophobes, not just in Britain, but particularly in the Nordic countries where there are even fewer Muslims than there are, you know, in Britain and other countries, is there's a lack of an institutional, organizational defense for Muslim communities. And that, because we don't have that, it means that there's no real deterrent for these would-be attackers. And when we did have those protests, or that it was effective. But these broad institutional failures among Muslims globally, that is what really has emboldened these enemies of Islam and Muslims to take these sorts of actions, which of course is encouraged by the rhetoric of various governments. The problem that we have in the Muslim community that you know, the Jewish community, for example, doesn't have is we don't have a sort of structure of state-funded community defense organizations like the Community Security Trust, which is a lobbying group that's funded by the British government. There's no, you know, Muslim Shomrim. There's no organized community defense force. There are no legal organizations that lobby explicitly to protect Muslim interests. It's not even necessarily about Muslims going into politics. It's about Muslims having the capacity to be able to influence political change, which doesn't necessarily need to happen by people being elected to parliament. They can become lobbyists, and they can we can develop organizations that actually have clout politically. So I think we do have to come together to protect our communal interests, because the ones that exist at the moment, organizations in Britain, for example, like Tell Mama, have been so heavily subverted, in my view, and penetrated by agents of causes that are completely hostile to Muslims. So we don't really have any real advocacy organizations.
Farah, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think the solution is? Because as we've discussed in this show, there is many different types of Islamophobia. We have entire governments that are supportive of this viewpoint. And right now in the UK, they won't even define Islamophobia. There isn't even a government-recognized definition of the term Islamophobia. So we don't even know how to combat it if we can't even define it. So what do you mean? What's the solution?
I think the solution here is to put more kind of leaders of Muslim communities in positions of power and influence. So they're, you know, they're the ones really deciding kind of what policies are Islamophobic, what policies you know are harmful to the Muslim community. The likes of tokenism in regards to the Conservative Party, where they place these politicians who may be people of colour or maybe of a certain religion, but then still, you know, kind of implement the same harsh policies that their white counterparts would implement isn't good enough anymore. We actually need representation behind those kind of token figures.
I'm going to bring it to you, Amar. The same question to you. There is an issue with political representation, I think, because Hamza Youssef, the leader of the SNP now in Scotland, he's being criticised as to whether he's even a Muslim anymore because he's seen as compromising on his Islamic values to obtain that position. But what about the idea of if you are principled like Jeremy Corbyn and stand by your views, then you'll be denied the opportunity with the establishment turning on you to keep you out of positions of power. What do you think? Do you think that there's any chance of gaining any real political representation for Muslims in the West?
I do think it's very difficult if you're a practicing Muslim to become a politician of any influence in this country. And that's why now I'm primarily focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. And I think having, you know, strong communal organizations is one way in which Muslims can assert themselves, because, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, for example, who was seen by the security establishment in Britain as being politically Muslim because of his proximity to Muslim communities in Britain, you know, he was, as one data pointed out, a victim of Islamophobia in and of himself, and he wasn't even a Muslim. And you can see the way in which Muslims are attacked, because the aim of these individuals, people like Keir Starmer, for example, who are servants of the security establishment, is they want to, and they've been quite successful, actually, in ejecting Muslims from public life. And they're doing that at the behest of not only the security state here in Britain, but also at the behest of Zionist entrists who represent the interests of a hostile foreign regime. So my view is the current political situation is very difficult to be a practicing Muslim. We should be focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. Of course, that doesn't mean we give up on politics, but we also need to be realistic about the way in which the tide is flowing at this particular moment in time. And that's my personal view.
A very good point to end on. Thank you very much to both my guests. That's all we have time for on this edition of the show. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio.
visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
According to the American media, some U.S. Republican senators and Donald Trump's former strategic allies are not sure that he can succeed in the 2024 election due to his poor personality and performance and the damage done to his image following the criminal charges against him and revelations of the Congressional Investigation Committee about the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The New York Post has covered this story and tells us more. Former Attorney General of the United States William Barr has sounded the alarm, saying Donald Trump will create chaos and a horror show if he is elected president in 2024. Speaking at an event in Cleveland, Ohio on Friday, 5th of May, former Attorney General William Barr said Donald Trump lacked the discipline to achieve the policies that he is promising. William Barr, who served as the U.S. Attorney General in the administration of former Presidents George H.W. Bush and Donald Trump, said, "If you believe in his policies, what he's advertising as his policies, he's the last person who could actually execute them and achieve them." William Barr added, "Trump does not have the discipline." He also said that Donald Trump lacked the mental capacity to set priorities or think strategically. William Barr continued, "Trump doesn't have the ability for strategic thinking or setting priorities." He described Donald Trump's conduct as what one would expect to see in a horror movie. William Barr said, "It is a horror show when he's left to his own devices. And so, you may want his policies, but Donald Trump will not deliver Trump policies." Barr noted the only goal that Donald Trump is capable of achieving through his divisive rhetoric and actions is to create division, to wreak havoc, and deliver chaos in society. William Barr added, "He will deliver chaos and, if anything, lead to a backlash that will set his policies much further back than they would otherwise would be." In Trump's inaugural speech in January of 2017, he promised to end the American carnage by painting a bleak picture of a divided, dysfunctional nation that he alone could fix. Donald Trump, who is now seeking a second term in office in 2024, has been promoting himself in U.S. society as a successful leader and defender of U.S. values and a supporter of American heroes, who is himself being attacked mercilessly by those who aim to defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. He said, "We're now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, and the looters." In the meantime, Trump has been described by some of the officials who have worked alongside him in the past as a nasty, cruel, and violent person, that is, even feared by most of his own party members. According to experts in sociology and psychology, Donald Trump's dangerous rhetoric provides his extreme followers with fodder to exert violence in society. The Newsweek magazine has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump has hit back at William Barr after the former Attorney General of the United States predicted it would be chaos and a horror show if Trump is re-elected as president. Writing on Truth Social, Donald Trump accused William Barr of being a weak and slovenly man who didn't want anything to do with the rigged election claims. Barr resigned as Attorney General in December of 2020 after Donald Trump continued to falsely suggest that the election he lost to Joe Biden was stolen from him due to widespread voter fraud, even after William Barr publicly stated that the U.S. Justice Department had found no evidence to back up Donald Trump's claims. In response to William Barr's comments, Donald Trump attacked his one-time ally and the work he did as Attorney General and suggested he actually fired William Barr from his position in late 2020. Donald Trump wrote, "Bill Barr was a weak and slovenly man who was ill-equipped to be Attorney General because he was literally in fear of the radical left Democrats and all they were threatening to do to him. He did fine with Russia, Russia, and Russia, but it should have been gotten rid of as a made-up Democrat con job much faster." He said William Barr was most afraid of anything having to do with the rigged election because he knew that it was this subject more than any other that the Democrats did not want to even think about. Trump added, "They got away with murder, so no more discussions with the possibility of getting caught. They wanted it over. I got very tough with William Barr and pushed him hard to do his job, but he just couldn't overcome his fear of the radical left. He was useless. I nicely fired him. He's now a soundbite." This is not the first time that William Barr and Donald Trump have exchanged verbal blows. In a March 2022 interview with NBC News to promote his memoirs, William Barr described how Donald Trump showed a detachment from reality post-2020 election, including accepting a conspiracy theory that Dominion voting machines were used to rig the ballots. William Barr said, "He was willing to accept anything, no matter how fanciful, as long as it didn't make him a loser in the election." William Barr added that Donald Trump was the maddest I've ever seen him when he handed him his resignation letter over what then Attorney General described as incorrect election fraud claims. In response, Donald Trump said, "William Barr crumbled under pressure and bowed to the radical left, but not accepting the false election claims." Donald Trump also claimed that it is incorrect and a total fabrication that William Barr handed in his resignation and that he was the one to ask for it. American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's fellow Republicans, including even some of his strongest allies, want him to stay away from the 2024 presidential race amid his legal troubles. Senate Republicans, including members of leadership, say Donald Trump should stay out of the 2024 Senate primaries in order to avoid a repeat of last year's disappointing midterm elections. Trump, who announced his presidential campaign in November, has become the first former U.S. president to face criminal charges after a grand jury voted to indict him in New York over a hush money payment made to the film actress Stormy Daniels during the 2016 presidential election. Republican lawmakers fear he will mire the GOP candidates in debates over his pet issues such as election fraud and defunding the Department of Justice, instead of issues that matter to the American voters, such as the economy, the rate of inflation, and health care. They also worry that Donald Trump's endorsements, again, will be more driven by how the perceived candidate's loyalty to him and his agenda than on the electability in November. Senate Republican Whip John Thune said it will be better if Donald Trump stayed out of the way. Senator Lindsey Graham also said, if I were Trump, I'd focus on my own election, but I doubt if he'll take that advice. Many GOP lawmakers believe that Donald Trump hurt Republican chances in Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania by endorsing candidates from Republicans in Washington did not view as candidates with the best chance of winning the general election.
Bazaar.
Wherever you go, you are surrounded by real estate, whether they are houses, offices, shops, hotels, or education, or even healthcare facilities. These buildings are all the products of Realty Development. Property is a multi-business. It can involve buying land and building on it, renovating or improving, or converting property from one use to another. All of which adds higher value to the area. Property developers quite literally build the world around us, creating and changing the environments we inhabit and use on our daily basis.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly programme that analyses markets, profits, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will take a look at Iran's housing and light construction industry. We want to uncover how this market is doing and what contributions it is making to living standards along with the economy. Time to light up today's Bazaar.
In order to become more familiar with the activities of light construction in Iran, we decided to visit a real estate developer in the capital city, Tehran. Nexa Group was established over a decade ago and is a known name in the construction industry. Essentially, it develops luxury properties for residential purposes. In a nutshell, a developer adds value to land or property. What sets this company apart from other developers is its choice of cream-of-the-crop architects who are highly creative, innovative, and experienced in the field of design. Clients who have land they wish to develop can seek the services of this contractor. This company then enters a contract with the owner and begins the process of vetting architects for designing its buildings. In recent years, several competitions have been held by this developer for residential projects. The winning design that meets the high standards of this company and its clients is awarded the project. But that's not all. This company also has a vast network of highly specialized subcontractors to take care of other aspects of construction, such as structure engineering, excavators, and so on. Among its many activities, this developer provides building management services. Such services include maintenance of plumbing, electrical, and mechanical installations of the building.
There are several different types of property development. Some are large-scale, meaning that several lots of land are being developed into a single plot. These types of developments can be subdivided and sold individually or as a whole. There are also developments for commercial and sports uses, such as shopping centers and stadiums. Ooh, I like the sound of this.
Projects at this company range from low to medium density residential buildings. This developer also pays particular attention to designing buildings that are environmentally friendly. Most of its buildings are constructed following green practices that also elevate the living standards and quality of experience of its end users. One of its most recent residential projects is called Phoenix. What is most unique about this building is that it was designed based on the traditional nine-square method of Iranian architecture. This green building incorporates the needs of people during the coronavirus pandemic, which includes spaces for working from home. Large investments are made in real estate development each day, but adding value to the property, such as luxury structures with numerous amenities, are what really drive profits. And this company is ready to work with foreign investors and export its services along these lines. One of the competitive advantages of this developer, relative to others in the country, are its innovative and exceptional designs that gain the attention of clients and customers. Its luxury developments are geared to entice customers with more accommodations, higher-end options that integrate an entire lifestyle, and an elevated culture of living. The quality of its work has increased competition in the domestic market, making its buildings a must-have among customers. This property developer also has a unique view of the US-imposed sanctions, which has helped the company thrive throughout the years.
Iran has a growing population of around 85 million people, and the majority of the population is still young. But as time goes by, this population will age as they start families. With this in mind, many of them are embarking on the journey of purchasing homes. And for this to become possible, more housing units need to be constructed to meet this growing need.
The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development estimates that the per capita of housing for each Iranian is around 200 square meters. This means that 17 billion square meters of buildable land is needed to house every Iranian. According to the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development, the annual demand for homes stands at 900,000 units. In more general terms, according to the Ministry of Housing, some 10 million units are currently needed. This is while the average annual production volume for homes is around 300,000 units. So around 1 million residential units need to be built each year to satisfy this demand. Figures from the Statistics Center of Iran show construction of housing increased by nearly 40% last year. Data from the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development show municipalities issue an average of 350,000 residential construction permits each year. Of this amount, roughly 70% lead to construction. However, experts say this is not nearly enough to meet annual housing demands. Last year, the housing construction market saw a slump in completing projects. This was mainly due to the jump in land prices and construction materials that deepened the housing recession. The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development says housing prices have increased by 200% over the last 5 years. This has increased the purchase parity, making some vulnerable groups unable to buy a home.
It might be interesting to know that this issue has gathered the attention of the government for some time now. The government has implemented initiatives to help people purchase homes. One of these initiatives was to increase the amount of bank loans for first home buyers. Several other plans are also underway, such as the vacant house tax plan, to increase the amount of available homes.
President Ibrahim Raisi has pledged to build 1 million residential units each year for the next 4 years. This scheme was presented to address and prevent a housing shortage in the country. The Building Contractors Association says planning, execution, and building material is available. It emphasized that with large investments and land allocation, this plan can easily go forward. But authorities contend that infrastructure such as electricity and water connectivity requires more planning. Government officials also say wrinkles in the financial model for this project still need to be ironed out. Iran is entirely self-sufficient when it comes to construction material, according to the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. Steel, glass, and cement is produced in abundance in the country. In fact, the surplus of these items are exported to several countries around the world. Meanwhile, the light construction industry in Iran is booming amid a long housing recession. New spaces and innovative designs that incorporate the needs of people are being built. Homes are not just a place to live, they are increasingly being seen as a source of capital and a place to increase the quality of living standards. There is also a growing trend towards designing sustainable buildings that reduce emissions and negative environmental impacts. All these achievements make this industry a promising one with a bright future. It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy. Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested.
Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card, so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs.
Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future.
It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
In 2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit.
Now it's that time of the show for me to step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague has another awesome field report lined up for you. Take it away.
The basis of the steel industry is iron ore. It's courtesy of this critical raw material that steel is all around us. In the beneficiation process, the gank minerals, or the mineral matter of no value that occurs with the metallic ore, is removed from the mineral substance and iron ore concentrate is produced. The concentrate is then shipped from mining plants as a bulk commodity by rail.
Hi again. The wagons carrying the iron ore concentrate have reached their destination. What happens at this stage is that through a gargantuan machine, they are overturned. This is called a wagon tippler. What it does is that it tips the wagons. Look, it retains the wagons from the top and it overturns them. First, the wagons are detached from other wagons and then they're lifted over here. And look at those arms. Look at those arms, how gigantic they are. And now they're going to retain the wagon, overturn it to empty its load into a container. From that container, the iron ore concentrate is going to be mixed. First, it's going to travel through some distance and is going to be mixed with some additives to be fed into the pelletizing process.
In this week's feature program, we visited Chahrmalu Industrial Facility located in the center of Iran, Yazd province. The iron ore concentrate must be pelletized for use in iron and steel making. In summary, pelletizing is achieved by combining the iron ore with water and a specific binder, which is then rolled up in a balling drum to produce relatively uniform pellets, which can then be easily handled in downstream processes.
And here we are. The powder is the iron ore concentrate now mixed with some additive. It is now fed into large discs. In this industrial complex, everything is just enormous. This is called the pelleting disc. It's really huge. Now what happens here is through the use of centrifugal force, the powder gets compressed and it's just pushed to the edges of this disc, and after the powder completes a couple rotation, and as it grows in size, then it forms the pellets, and once it is just large enough, it will exit the rotation because of that centrifugal force, and it moves over to the conveyor belt, and it's now time for grading. Now, those particles that are just perfect in size and shape, they will move on to travel over to the kiln, where the content moisture is removed and sintering takes place, so the iron pellet now gets hardened, and after that, cooling takes place. Now, stay with us for more.
Chaturmalu's pelletizing plant, with a production capacity of 3.4 million tons per year, employs 500 people directly and another 3,000 indirectly. The iron ore pellets will be transferred to stackers and are piled in an area which can store 300,000 tons of pellets.
Fe2O3, I don't know how familiar you are with chemistry and the chemical reactions and the periodic table, but anyway, at this stage of the process, Fe2O3 is going to be turned into Fe through a process that is called direct reduction of iron. And this process is done by three main stages. The first stage occurs above furnace. The pellets are poured into the furnace. And what happens inside the furnace is two gases are going to hit the pellets. The gases are carbon monoxide and molecular hydrogen. They're extracted from natural gas through a process that is called reformation. And two gases are going to hit the pellets, and through three chemical reactions, Fe2O3 is going to turn into Fe, which is called the reduced iron, or also sponge iron because of its high porosity. Now, this process can be done in two different ways. One is called hot direct reduction of iron, and the other one is called cold direct reduction of iron. Now, I'm going to move on to the next and the final stage, steel production.
Hot direct reduced iron, or HDRI, is DRI that is transported hot directly from the reduction furnace into an electric arc furnace, thereby saving energy. Whereas cold DRI is the one that is cooled and stored before being charged to a furnace. Well, on the face of it, there's no reason for facilities to even consider cold DRI, but in reality, it's not really that simple. The development of mankind would have been impossible but for steel. It fueled the Industrial Revolution and remains the backbone of modern industrialized economies. The process continues with primary steelmaking, which is done via electric arc furnace at Chaturmalu, and then moves on to secondary steelmaking, which involves treating, continuous casting, and shaping.
The final product is made, the steel billet, and you can tell how hot it is in here. Well, the process here starts with the electric arc furnace. It melts the sponge iron that I talked about earlier. And what happens next is that we need some ladles. Ladles are containers. They're going to contain the molten material. Then the ladles are taken over some molds. Molds are going to carry the molten material. And as the molten material is carried over some distance, it solidifies into the final product, which is the steel billet. Now, this complex is really huge. Everything inside it is gigantic. And I've been with you from the very beginning of this process, the iron concentrate, to the very end.
Thanks for that educational adventure once again. Well, that covers our show for today. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.